Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to meet an expert who gives us information that allows us to expand our thoughts, to engage in critical thinking. And today's guest is certainly no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She is the Stanley and Deborah Lefkowitz Distinguished Faculty Fellow in the Department of Psychology at Temple University, and she is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Kathy, your business card must be quite long.
We cram a lot on there.
I can understand that. But thank you very much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Well, thank you so much, Pamela, for inviting me. It is truly a pleasure to be here.
Well, today we're going to talk about a book that you have written, which is entitled Becoming Brilliant.
Yes, Becoming Brilliant.
I was kind of hoping that if I read it, I would be brilliant, or I could just look at the cover and be magically brilliant.
Sleep on it.
Oh, that's what I didn't do.
Oh, there you go.
All right. The subtitle is What Science Tells Us About Raising Successful Children. So something that many people are very much interested in.
Right.
Tell us about, we're going to be talking about the science of how children learn, and you've identified six skills that help children become the thinkers and entrepreneurs of tomorrow. Before we go into that, you heard me say in the introduction that Thoughtful Thursdays are really about enhancing folks' critical skills, critical thinking skills.
Mm-hmm.
What, in your view, what is critical thinking and why is it important?
Well, I think it's critically important even for getting through our day. So what is critical thinking, Pamela? It's a great question. It's not just accepting information. It's asking questions about it. It's trying to see if there's any evidence that could sway you one way or another on an issue. Like, should I be eating this food or not be eating this food? Should I be taking this medication or not taking this medication? Is this the kind of program that's really going to advance me in school or not advance me in school? Well, there are kind of objective answers to a lot of these. If I take one kind of course, then it's going to prepare me to be a dentist. If I take another kind of course, there's evidence that people who take it are going to do well if they want to be a librarian. But we have to weigh that evidence. And often what we do, especially in an environment where we are literally flooded, even flood's not enough, let me say the tsunami of information that is doubling every 2.5 years, sometimes we just take what we see. And I think a lot of us learned that lesson on both sides of the aisle during this last election. There was a lot of fake news out there, but none of us had the time or the inclination to ask the questions about what we were reading. We just repeated the stories we saw from the fake news cycle. That's not critical thinking. And if we're going to survive well, especially in a society, in a democracy, we have to know how to sift out the bad stuff and look at the evidence and where we want to go. That's critical thinking.
So, in fact, it sounds like the ability to engage in critical thinking is as essential to one's emotional and psychological awareness and well-being as breathing is to the body.
I believe that's really true, and I'm thrilled to see that you're concentrating on that skill. I mean, even I remember when I was an adolescent, and I wanted to convince my mom that she should let me go out to a movie. I still had to bring the evidence to bear. So, yeah, it's critical thinking.
So, in fact, children, this is something that children learn early on or can be encouraged to learn. Let's talk about the six skills that you've identified that will help children become the kinds of thinkers that you're talking about. The first skill is
absolutely
collaboration. Why is that
important?
All right,
well, let me start by just saying that what I am so excited about is that these six skills that we're going to talk about, they're as relevant to the young child as they are to the middle schooler, as they are to the college student, as they are to the business person. And many of them were derived by talking to scholars and people who study business and realizing that what the business community is looking for at the end of the day is also exactly what helps our young kids become successful as they march through early education in school. So collaboration, you gotta get along with other people. It is a foundational skill. These social skills that allow us to navigate our environment are the things that help us become popular, help us be part of a crowd, help us learn from one another. They feed into teamwork as we grow up, those doing the projects together. They help us understand how to be members of a community and not just take something that we want if someone else is playing with it. So this collaboration skill, this ability to control your impulse, is at the core of everything. It's who we are, social.
Now, you know that for many folks, particularly in this society, it really is all about me. It's about what I want and how I'm going to get what I need. Maybe I don't feel like collaborating. Maybe I don't have time to collaborate. Maybe I don't even value collaboration as a skill. What do you say to that person?
Ah, that person will be living on an isolated island. You know, it's very hard in today's world to get along without collaboration because everything is done through teams. You know, it's amazing if you go in and have an x-ray today. I mean, the world doesn't shut down. It's so global that the x-ray might be red in India while you're asleep for the night. Everybody's working in teams, and it's made the world as small as my friend always says, a walnut, you know? It's so small, you can go round and round it so quickly with our current communication. Look, we have to learn to work together because none of us can master all of it ourselves. And I agree with you as we move to the second C, which is communication. You know, we have all learned how to blab a lot. I see posts on Facebook every night that tell me like what my friends had for dinner. You know, like, do I really care?
I was about to ask you that.
What their dinner plate looked like. And the answer is no. I'd love to know the news about their family. But I don't need to know everything they did during the day. And maybe if we learned to listen a little bit more and not just blab, or learned rhetoric, or learned how to write, or learned to have a conversation, even when we're reading a book, we have a conversation with the author, we'll be better off. And that's communication that's built, of course, on collaboration.
And again, I bring up the fact of the world in which we live, in which communication, certainly for a significant portion of the population, is about texting, not even emailing so much. It's really texting and Snapchatting or, you know, all these. That's their idea of communicating.
Yeah, exactly. Now, look, it does mean that you're connecting, for sure. But gosh, I'll tell you, maybe I'm just an old fogey, but I love to hear my kids' voices. And I get more out of hearing the emotionality, the timbre of the voice, than I would if I just got a text. So I think there's still something to the human quality. You know where you can really see it? Have you ever made a plane reservation or a train reservation, or your newspaper didn't come on time, right? And you call that magic number that's called customer service? Honestly, it doesn't feel like customer service to me.
You're right.
Okay? It just feels like something's talking at me. And so I think there's still something to that human quality.
And, you know, as I'm thinking about what you're saying, it's interesting because there really are some businesses nowadays that are, not enough, but there are some who are actually saying, and you get a live person when you talk on the phone.
Right. They're advertising it. Isn't it incredible?
It is absolutely
like,
extraordinary.
People.
Right.
I know sometimes I push zero all the time. You can find me pounding zero saying, human. So The minute we feel that way, we should recognize that so too do our kids, and that the real power of communication is person to person. It all gets back to that collaboration. Human beings, the thing that differentiates us from the apes is, I mean, genetically, we share 99%. But what's really different is that we are social, maybe even ultra-social. We need other people.
So collaboration and communication, critical parts of what's important for children to be aware of.
Absolutely. And I must say, I'm lucky enough to have this, of course, brilliant, wonderful granddaughter. And Ellie, even, I mean, even when I watch her on FaceTime, you know, when I'm not in Ann Arbor, just to watch how she looks into your eyes, you know, and the kind of communication she's constantly having with others, it is truly beautiful to see. And it rests on that back and forth on people.
And, you know, it is beautiful to see. And sadly, again, because I think that so much of our world is wrapped around the internet and electronics, the idea of actually engaging in eye contact doesn't happen as much as it should.
No, and it's quite interesting when you raise it around the screen time. I mean, an enormous proportion of kids under 4 have daily access to screens, something like 65%. It's huge, and are using screens a large portion of the time. So we have to ask, you know, what's the impact? Now, if it's good screen time, it's fine. Depends on the programming. And let me tell you, that is hard to find because there are over 82,000 apps just for the preschool set. Can you imagine that?
No, I can't. 82,000?
Yeah, just for the preschool set. And that number's growing every single day. But it's also not just what our kids are using. It's what we're using that is breaking the social relationship and breaking the communication. So we just finished a study in our lab that was so interesting. We had a mom teaching a child two new words that we made up. And in one condition, the mom's interactions with her child, these children were 2.5, was broken by a cell phone call, okay? And in another, it was not broken by the cell phone call. Now, I would ask your listeners, where did the child learn the word? Under what condition? Well, guess what? They didn't learn when it was broken by a cell phone call. But the kids did learn when they had that back and forth and it was uninterrupted. This is Jessa Reed's work. And wow, that should be telling us something as we walk around the world with our cell phones constantly in hand, not noticing the eyes of our children. We're breaking the social.
And it sounds like actually making our children and ourselves smaller in terms of our ability to connect.
And I bet, you know, you'll see all those people in your practice because the outcome is that, you know, we're essentially saying, well, I mean, you're not as important as what I have on, you know, on screen right now.
Right. You know? There was a conversation I heard a few days ago recommending that young people who were looking to get a job, that they really needed to engage in eye contact.
Yes.
Now, it's so interesting that that was a piece of advice that was necessary.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And but notice, you know, our eyes, in fact, I had a funny scene a couple of months ago with one of my sons. I have three adult sons. And one of them sitting across the table with me from dinner and constantly looking at his cell phone, you know, and doing it in a way that was trying to hide that he was looking at his cell phone. You know what I mean? You've probably seen that.
Absolutely.
That look down, but I'm not really looking down.
Hardly ever
certainly
works.
Not looking
yeah.
at you, right? and when that happened, at one point I thought, okay, this has to end. So I just sent him a text and said, hey, hi, over here, other side of table, it's your parents calling, you know, just to see if we could get some eye contact moving.
Did it work?
Yeah, it did. And I think just putting these things away for a little bit. I actually think for younger kids too. I'm thinking about a new phenomenon that I call secondhand screens. Because I think these screens are really drawing kids' attentions, just like, you know, dessert would if you put it on the table with the broccoli.
Right.
I mean, you know, who's going to eat the broccoli?
Exactly.
Right. So anyway, collaboration and communication are the first two C's. And together, they prepare us for content, which is the third C. Now, we have an obsession in our culture with content. I mean, we want our, you know, two-year-olds to know the ABCs.
Right.
We want our three-year-olds to be reading already. Like, if they don't start reading, oh, my God, how are we ever going to catch them up? So I think what we have to start realizing is that it's not all about the test score. It's not all about learning content. So let's break it down a little bit. For one, if we want our kids to be strong in preparation for school and all the way through school, guess what? They have to have collaboration and communication. Because if you don't have strong language skills, then you're not going to be able to get strong reading skills and good math skills, even math skills. And you're probably not going to do well in social studies. So we have to think about a full range of skills, what we call a breadth of skills, even to do well on the test. But given that information is doubling every 2.5 years, exponentially growing, it means that even if you knew every fact, every bit of content today, in 2.5 years, you'd only know 50%. And in 5 years, you'd only know 25%.
Interesting.
Right. So the trick then is learning to learn skills, which is also part of content and goes under a fancy title in our field, which is sometimes called executive function skills. And these are skills like memory, attention, flexibility, problem solving. You have to have that so that you can tackle new problems and learn new information.
Now, a moment ago, you said something that's I am so certain has many young parents' heads twisting around.
Go for it.
You just said that it's not all about the test score. How
right.
could you say something so
oh
horrifying?
Oh, my God. I know. So look, we've been groomed to believe that if you memorize and spit out, that that's going to be good enough. But heck, we've been teaching kids this for a long time, right?
Absolutely.
And our whole education system's built on it. Like, what was No Child Left Behind all about? So all these kids who went through No Child Left Behind, they now grow up and they're, you know, 15 and 16 and 17. So you must admit, if this is really the way kids learn, then they should be geniuses, right?
Indeed.
All right. Well, look at the latest PISA scores that came out 2 weeks ago. We did not look like geniuses in the United States. We did pretty poorly in science, reading, and math.
Interesting.
So you got to ask yourself, could we maybe better understand how kids learn? And maybe it's not about sit down, memorize, spit out, but maybe it's about having social engagement, being active learners, making things meaningful, learning how to transfer, learning how to ask questions, and learning in the context of other social beings, like teachers, not just on computers. We're not robots. So I think we have to change the way we think about it. And ironically, the tests that have been done in our field suggest that when you do look at a fuller breadth of skills, you actually do better on the tests than you do if you just concentrate on memorize and spit out.
Which makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, who is co-author with Roberta Mishnick-Golanoff of Becoming Brilliant, What Science Tells Us About Raising Successful Children. We're going to take a break, and we will be right back. We'll be right back. Dr. Hirsch-Pasek, I think about older parents and certainly grandparents, many of whom grew up in an era where children should be seen and not heard.
Yeah.
So collaboration, communication, the good child was the quiet child who quite frankly didn't communicate, just did what they were told. So again, you're turning all of that reasoning on its ear when you speak to the critical importance of collaboration and communication and a different way to pay attention to content.
Yeah, I'm not actually turning it all on its ear. The truth is that it's still okay and good to be polite, and it's all right to listen to your parents. But at the same time, having children learn how to collaborate with their peers, learn how to hold back their impulses so that they are polite to us, is part of what it means to become a social person who lives within a community. And in different cultural communities at different times in our history, that's been played out in different ways, but it's always been a collaborative child. What we don't want is Johnny's on the swing. You want the swing. So instead of waiting your turn, you go and clobber Johnny and get him off the swing. That's never been acceptable that I know of. So I think collaboration is still the way we go. On communication, we've always wanted our children to have strong communication skills. In fact, I think what really throws off older parents and grandparents is that this me generation talks so much about themselves that sometimes you think they're the center of the universe. So, again, I'm not sure that has totally changed. I think we're saying we want people to be polite, we want people to be gracious, and we want people to have strong communication skills so that they can get up in front of a crowd and be able to speak easily.
In terms of, I'm moving on to the next C, critical thinking. We're talking about, and your book is about raising successful children. So I'm not sure, that many folks will think about a critical thinking skill in the context of a child.
Ah, well, let me help you with that.
Okay.
Little kids are doing critical thinking all the time, asking questions, experimenting, trying to move to a means end and figure out, how does this work? Let me give you an example of critical thinking I saw yesterday. My granddaughter was experimenting with this little Band-Aid case. She's 18 months old. And she couldn't quite figure out how you get the Band-Aids out of the case. So at first she tried by pressing the Band-Aid case. Didn't quite work. The Band-Aid case didn't open. Having not worked, she tried a sliding maneuver. And the sliding maneuver actually worked. And she began to question it and experiment with it until she got open wide enough that she could put her pincer fingers in, pull out the Band-Aids. Now, it worked for getting the Band-Aids out, but it was very difficult when she wanted to return the Band-Aids back into the container. Look, I could go on, because I'm a developmental psychologist, forever telling you about this incredible scene that happened. But I hope what you can see is that she was constantly questioning to try to get the right solution to this scientific problem that she posed for herself. But let me give you another example.
Okay.
When her father was three, her father and I were reading a little book. I think it was called Babar. It was one of the Babar books.
Yes.
It wasn't a Babar book. That comes later in the story. But anyway, we're reading a book, and my son comes up to me and he says, "Mom, do all vehicles have wheels?" That's a great question.
It is.
Right? So I started thinking, well, cars have wheels, and trains have wheels, you know, bikes have wheels. And then I thought of boats, and I answered him, well, most vehicles have wheels, but, you know, not all vehicles have wheels, like boats don't have wheels. All right, so my son sat there, and he put on his thinking face, and it lasted for a while. He was deeply, deeply in thought, like Winnie the Pooh. And then he got up from the couch and he ran about the Babar book. Well, in this particular Babar book, it was the day that he had gotten a boat, the King Babar had gotten a boat for the monkey Zephyr. And believe it or not, when he was taking the boat to the lake, he had it on a carrier, and the carrier had wheels. Josh brought me the evidence to convince me that all vehicles had wheels.
That is priceless.
Critical thinking.
That's priceless.
So if we let them ask the questions, our young kids are capable of asking very deep questions. And yes, indeed, with those questions, they are doing critical thinking.
And clearly, it's so important to be available to your child such that your child can ask a question and that you are actually listening and paying attention to the question they're asking.
Yeah, and to value that question, because when we value their questions, we're actually valuing them and we're helping them learn. And that is just such an important piece. You know, it also turns out to be an important piece for the next C of creative innovation, right? So often we look at our kids' drawings and we plop them on the refrigerator, but we don't really look at them. And I can't tell you how much we can learn to see in a scribble, just a simple scribble. I've looked at two-year-old drawings. You know, to make that not-so-good circle on the two-year-old crayon drawing, that little kid had to keep his hand down. And to do that, he had to have the intent to keep his hand down and the fine motor coordination to keep his hand down. And then when he decides to put these blotches all over that piece of paper, a purple blotch and a red blotch and a yellow and a green, that kid has made a decision that he didn't just want to take the crayon and pound it onto the paper. So our children are being creative right in front of us. We just have to learn to see it.
Absolutely. And, you know, as I hear the excitement in your voice, as you're just describing that little child with the paper and the crayons, it's important that I would suspect all parents, all of us as human beings, have that same level of excitement when we are watching new learning.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to watch. And it does, you know, it does take this eagle eye sometimes to look beneath what you see. And just as we ask our kids to question, we have to question. And sometimes it's the things that we used to see as children and we've forgotten to see the magic. And if we can bring that magic back and see a whole child, not just prep for test score, then I think our kids will do better. And guess what? We'll have more fun as parents.
In terms of creativity, mm-hmm. we all know that children have unique ways of thinking about how they should dress, how they should wear their hair, what they mm-hmm. should do. And for many, the idea that a child should be allowed to, let's say, wear whatever he or she wants to wear is horrifying. And the parents get caught up in, what will the neighbors think? What will the school think? I'm in a school, I have my child in a school where uniforms are required. Talk to those parents.
Oh, my. I understand it, and I feel your pain. I mean, I have three sons, so I definitely went through some moments, you know, where I didn't want them to be embarrassed, and I guess secretly I didn't want me to be embarrassed either because I never thought stripes and plaids went together. but I will tell you, there were times when it got way more extreme for me, no kidding. Like one day, one of my sons wanted to dress up for a Jewish holiday that they have called Purim, okay? And there's a queen and a king in this, and the queen, absolutely, she is, you know, she's the person, Esther, who is the star of the story. So my son, who's 4, decides he has to dress up like Esther. And I'm thinking to myself, nope, you are not going to school dressed up as Esther, right? This was, like, not going to happen.
Okay.
So he said, but don't you always want me to, like, you know who the heroine is? And she's the heroine. I want to be Esther. And I thought to myself, I don't know why I care about this. I just don't want him to be embarrassed when he gets there. Because, you know, four-year-olds are relentless.
They can be.
Right? So I dress him in the most ambiguous, kingy-queeny way I possibly can. Right? Because, like, the queen could have a crown, so can the king. And off he goes to school. So we get into the school parking lot where the kind teachers are all there to have the kids go into school. And my one teacher says, "Oh, you dressed as King Ahasuerus." And my son looks at this teacher and goes, "No, I am Queen Esther." And I thought, well, there it is. Our kids have their own minds, and whatever the other kids say, he is now going to have to deal with it. And you know what? He did, and it was a good learning experience.
Which is so wonderful.
Yeah, so what if they wear plaids and stripes? Who really cares?
It's not the end of the world.
Yeah, and you know what? Sometimes it's not about us. Sometimes it's really about our kids. And we have to pick our battles. So that's what I would say to those parents.
Okay.
Let them be creative. Let them try.
Creativity is a good thing.
It's a good thing. And it's becoming more and more valued every day.
And, you know, I think about the parent who allows the child, actually even promotes creativity and mm-hmm. pays attention to the child and is sort of concerned about hearing what the child is really trying to say. And I think about the tremendous impact that has on self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, it's really interesting when I think again of my own parenting and getting out the door in the morning honestly felt like an achievement to me every day. I have three sons, and getting them to school on time, I was high-fiving myself. So, you know, that morning thing where you're in a rush, and then the kid wants another thing to eat, then they have to go to the bathroom, and you're just, like, never making progress. I learned that I would have a much easier time if I did some stuff the night before. So if I just let my kids pick what they wanted to wear the night before, I was then giving them the agency to say, hey, you know, I had a choice in this. And I was getting myself out the door the next morning. So it worked for everybody.
And again, I cannot stress enough the value and the importance of engaging in behaviors that actually grow a child's self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Versus stifling
and it
the self-esteem.
Yeah.
Which is
exactly.
So important. Talk about confidence.
Confidence. I love confidence. So, you know, we often leave this out, but this is kind of what you're saying, too. To grow self-esteem, you have to be able to try stuff. And sometimes, guess what? It's going to fail. Now, we can't let our children be dangerous, but we can let the tower fall down. And we can let them climb up a jungle gym. And when we don't, then our kids never learn from those failures. They never climb higher the next time we let them. There's a beautiful book called The Blessing of a Skin Knee, and I think it's such an important book and such an important message. How do we get what is called by my colleague a growth mindset? That's Carol Dweck's work. How do we not stop ourselves, but allow ourselves to reach our dreams, to fulfill our dreams, and to try, simply to try to build the tower a little bit taller? That's what confidence is all about.
So it's also about risk-taking. It's mm-hmm. about creativity. It's about critical thinking so that you're taking risks that make
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. Intellectual and physical risk. You know, it's interesting. I'm not saying risk that is dangerous.
Yes.
But why can't you, you know, put another color on that piece of paper or draw outside the lines? Why not? Who cares? It gives you a sense, as I say, of confidence and allows you to really experiment a little bit more with color, with drawing, with creativity. And importantly, these six C's all build on one another to create not only a whole person, but a dynamic view of learning that is based on the science. So communication requires collaboration. Content requires communication and collaboration. Critical thinking can't happen if you don't have content there. Creativity itself is built on having some knowledge and the confidence to give it a try, to get out there and really put yourself to the test, to take that risk intellectually and physically, is what's going to bring it all together.
So describe your sense of a really wonderful, encouraging, growth-producing school environment, classroom environment.
Well, when I look at classrooms now, I use this grid. What we've created for the book Becoming Brilliant is the 6 C's and then 4 levels on each of the C's. So collaboration, communication, content, critical thinking, creative innovation, and confidence. And in my own classes, what I am now doing is asking, am I a good enough teacher for my students? Have I put opportunities in my class to have my students grow as collaborators, communicators, content, critical thinking, etc.? So let's look at it at different levels. In a preschool classroom, collaboration asks, are kids doing things together? So when you look at the art in a classroom, you could have 2 murals that are side by side, or you could have the kids building a broader mural where they're each painting a part of it, or each doing a little mosaic, or they're building a larger structure at the puzzle corner together. Collaboration. Do they have a chance in circle time to tell their story, to bring in an artifact and to talk about it, something from home? Do they then have a chance to learn something about the content in this room? Or is it only content? Is it only ABCs on the wall? Or are they also learning to learn? Are there things that might capture their imagination, like a rig-a-majig, where they're putting it together and seeing how engineering really works? Or Play-Doh, where they can build something out of Play-Doh or Lego? Is there a chance for critical thinking? Are the things they have to figure out themselves? Do they have to spend some time that day in the preschool figuring out what is hidden in the pillowcase? And how would you know what's hidden in that pillowcase? Is there art? Is there a sand corner? And do they get a chance to try and to see how they do and to build from there? In a middle school classroom, I look for the same things, but of course with different elements. What there are they doing together? Are they doing science-y projects together? Are they trying them out? And how about in communication? Have they been asked to write a book report? And what's that book report look like? So you can see that you can look at a classroom and ask, is it offering the opportunity for my child to grow in all these areas? And you can do the same thing in your own living room.
And it sounds like, as you describe it, that it is certainly easy to accomplish if you're paying attention.
Exactly. So we think of this as a kind of grid, or if you will, even a self-report card for the 21st century. Ask, who are we, even in our business community? Are we like the type that likes to do everything on our own? Are we the type that sit in a cubby next to someone else and we kind of know what they're doing, but not really, and we hardly care? Or are we working collaboratively back and forth? I do a draft, you do a draft, I do a draft, you do a draft. How about communicating? Are there places in my work environment where I am allowed to communicate with others? And when I do, am I more of a show and tell? Or do I really want your feedback? How about my content? What do I know? How about my critical thinking? Do I use the evidence? Or do I just say, well, you know, it's a little bit warm outside today. Maybe that means there's global warming. So who am I? How do I arrange my space? How does my business work? If we can begin to understand ourselves using this grid, we can see our environments differently and our children differently.
Absolutely. Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, co-author of Becoming Brilliant, What Science Tells Us About Raising Successful Children. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. I am looking at the grid that you described a moment ago. And I'm looking under critical thinking. And I'm looking at level two, which indicates an awareness that truths differ. And then I think if we really could learn that, teach that, embrace that, celebrate that, would have a very different world.
No, we absolutely would. And, you know, it's a funny thing. As I look at it myself, there's the seeing is believing is sort of the level one. Okay, whatever you see must be the truth. And I saw it that way, so it couldn't be any other way. And then you realize, you know, that, like, you may see it differently than I do, and your truth is different than mine, but, of course, I'm right. And I think the next level is even healthier, which is we can have different opinions. We can even disagree on what the data are showing us. In fact, that happens all the time in medicine, which is why people go for second opinions.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely.
You want to know why? How do you take it? How do you look at this? What should I be doing? And of course, at the highest level, how do we use and bring the evidence to bear on the decisions that we make? And often it's, you know, there are a lot of decisions we're going to face with our children as well. Like, what courses should they take? What aren't so important? Does my child need to go into honors? Do they need to take that AP class? All these are decisions that we make. And we may find out that if he's in the honors class, he won't do as well in math. Is that a problem later for when he's going to apply to whatever? You know, we have to look at the data, the evidence, and bring it to bear. And not everyone's going to agree all the time. And I'd like to suggest that the healthiness of our system depends on our ability to speak with, to talk with, and to even understand that people will not always agree.
As we have been talking, what you have been consistently focused on is the individual, the human being, and what he or she needs to grow and do well. And I look at that up against actually what you said in the very beginning of your book when you talked about the New York Times article in October of 57 saying that, you know, the Russians were beating us. And then all of a sudden, Congress passes a National Defense Education Act, and on and on. And all of these things seem to grow out of a need to be better than the other guy, to beat the other guy, versus actually embracing the full and robust learning that really does make us a better country and better individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really key, and I think if we can all begin to, you know, adopt this kind of a framework, we'll learn how to get along better as well. But there is, you know, there's a secret in all of this, at least from the scientific point of view, that when we do collaborate more and when we're not assuming that it's just about jumping ahead for the grade, and notice it's not to say not to get better grades, but to jump ahead for the grades, we're actually going to do better in the grades. And that's the secret weapon. The secret weapon is that learning is a fuller breadth of skills. And many countries now are really starting to embrace that. And as we move into a world that's more complicated and we understand more about the science, we'll see that the kids who succeed, the future CEOs, the future entrepreneurs, the future, even the future working class folks, are going to need to have broader skills because the rest can be replaced with machines.
Interesting. You say that soft skills, which many people would sort of poo-poo as, you know, just really not all that important, you say that soft skills are anything but.
Anything but. And in fact, I even oppose the use of the term soft skills. I always put it in quotations because it's like, no, they're not soft, you know. And I think, you know, a perfect example, again, comes from reading. So, for example, when we learn to read, when we learn to do the letter sound correspondence, which is all very important, But when we learn to read, even if we're perfect at letter-sound correspondence, we're translating the visual into something that's meaningful in our heads and in our mental dictionaries. If we don't have vocabulary, if we don't have the social skills that build the vocabulary, then reading is going to be meaningless. It's just like reading Greek. You could translate it, but it doesn't translate into anything that has any meaning for you. So even something as basic as reading depends on communication skills and collaboration skills. The soft skills simply aren't soft.
You talk about a flipped classroom.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, flipped classrooms are really in vogue these days, because what we're learning more and more is that when we speak at people and expect them to learn, they learn only on the surface. But let me give you an example. You may remember trying to learn those SAT words where you crammed 400 words into your head to take the test. And the day after the test, if I had asked you to define any of those words, you would be at a real loss, right?
The words are all gone.
The words are all gone. That's not deep learning. What we need if we're really going to be learners is to take information in, be able to use that information, and to transfer it so that we not only remember it over a period of time, but we transfer it to a new problem space. Well, as people started realizing that the cram and regurgitate wasn't working, they saw it in classrooms and colleges as well. And in those classrooms, one famed example comes from physics. And they gave people who had taken a Harvard physics class a test on basic physics about whether a heavier object fell faster than a lighter object. And the students, after an entire semester, got it wrong. So that led people to assume that we were teaching in the wrong way, and that the fountain of knowledge model of people who were going to tell you everything they needed to know in a classroom lecture for you to then go home and study it more and come back and take the test simply wasn't working. So they came up with an idea called a flipped classroom, which is where you learn the material at home, or at least familiarize yourself with the material at home, and when you get into that classroom, you use it like a lab. So learning becomes much more active and engaged, much more meaningful, and much more social. And in effect, this kind of active learning is what we see when we play around with stuff, when we become the grand experimenters. And so sometimes you see the six C's best when you're playing. And the flipped classroom is one incarnation of a way that can look.
And in your view, would it be wise for colleges, universities to utilize the flipped classroom concept throughout?
A lot of people are doing it, and it seems to be working. A lot of universities have moved in that direction. For my own classes, what I'm doing is a kind of melding of two forms. I try to have discussion-based, lecture for the first class of the week, and then for the second class of the week, I move to pure discussion and experimentation so that they get the information, and then they can play around with it. And that's really when you learn, and that's when you hold on to information.
You say, you speak to some of those parents who believe that if their child goes to a particular school, mm-hmm. their success is assured, and if they don't, woe is the end of the world. and we all know about the parents who put their children on the list for the nursery school before the child is born.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So does it matter what college you go to, what university you go to, what school
Largely
you go to?
Not.
Largely not.
Yeah, I mean, there is great stuff in so many universities around this country and in many, many schools. So there's a lot of not great stuff, to be honest, especially in some of the schools that I've walked into. We have to learn what to look for, and it has to fit with us. So, for example, if you are an outdoor kind of kid who likes small discussion and experimentation, going to a school where you're going to be in the mountains of Maine is a really good fit for you. And there are great schools there that will allow you to have that discussion-based learning as your primary. If you're somebody who's really into the Big Ten, then you want to go to a school where you can do the rah-rah. But you will get an equally good education at almost all these environments if you're the gardener who knows how to nurture that education. But it shouldn't just be spoon-fed. We make of education what we put into it.
What you're describing in so many ways, it takes work, it takes attention, it takes energy, it takes time for the harried, perhaps single or even double parent household. They just don't have the time for all this stuff that you're talking about.
I actually disagree with you.
Okay.
I don't think it takes one iota extra time. In fact, it may even take less time. Because the kinds of things that I'm talking about can be nurtured as we're running around going to the supermarket, as we're driving in the car and having a conversation with our kids instead of watching that movie, when we are, you know, doing our daily errands, when we're walking someplace and noticing the nature along the way. It doesn't take any more time. It takes more awareness, but it doesn't take any more time.
What you're describing then is the reverse of what I just proposed, because
exactly.
What you're saying is that this kind of experiential learning can happen anywhere, anytime, all the time.
All the time. And guess what? It's way cheaper than the educational toys. Way cheaper. This can be done on a zero budget, but we just have to recognize that the learning is there. I always talk about it as changing the lens on the way we see something. It doesn't take us any more time to notice that that two-year-old's color drawing that we just put on the refrigerator had different color blotches and that the kid had to use intent. It takes no more time. It's just that we see it differently. And when we see the world differently through the grid of the six C's, we then understand what true learning is all about. It's not just memorizing what we saw in a textbook. It's understanding why that was put in the textbook, and that we get from the world around us.
And sadly, I would suggest in so many schools, they really do teach to the test, and a lot of educators are absolutely objecting to it, but that's kind of the lay of the land right now in many places.
It is. And it's sad that it is, because those kids will get out of that test and won't know what to do with that information when they get to the next test. And I will tell you, even at college courses that I teach, I have seen students say, well, wait a minute, you didn't expect us to remember what we did in the first quiz. And I said, yeah, actually, believe it or not, learning is cumulative. Learning is cumulative. So I would love to see learning be a bit more fun, a bit more experimental. But notice it doesn't always have to be fun. Learning our multiplication tables may not be fun, but it's very important to do. We have to make sure we're not always just relying on the lookup features in the computer or on the calculator. We know what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, because we have learned the foundational knowledge, the academic knowledge. And that you just have to get. But boy, we could do it better. And I think the six C's gives us a way of looking at that.
Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, co-author of Becoming Brilliant, What Science Tells Us About Raising Successful Children. Is there a website that folks can go to learn more about what you're doing?
You bet. You can go to becoming_brilliant.com, and that says a little bit more about the book. And you can also go to my personal website, which is Kathy Hirsch, H-I-R-S-H, Pasek, P-A-S-E-K, with a dash in between. And if you go there, and that's a .com as well, then you can see all the stuff that we're doing in our lab and some of our outreach programs.
And that's Kathy with a K.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Alrighty. Thank you, Dr. Hirsch-Pasek, so much for joining us today and really walking us through a different way, I would say a more expansive way of learning and retaining what we learn and being more creative in our worlds and the worlds of our children.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Well, again, thank you very much. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available daily on demand by going to myndtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.